Joining us now is Democratic political strategist Tad Devine. Welcome to our program.
Nice to be with you.
Let's talk for a minute about why these kinds of things happen and what sort of response that politicians need to have to deal with a gas price crisis. President Obama has announced a new gas task force, which he says is to root out fraud and manipulation in oil and gas markets that might affect prices. What do you think this is? Is this mostly theater? Could this change anything?
Well, I think it's evidence that the president wants to pick sides in this, and the side that he's going to pick is the side of the consumers and not oil companies, Wall Street, speculators. And it's, I think, potentially a very powerful signal. But gas prices can undermine a presidency. It's such a visible thing in our lives. I mean, there's not another commodity, I think, that you drive by outside a supermarket or another place where you see the actual price of the commodity and it's visible to everyone. And now people are so aware of how much it costs and how quickly it's rising. And I think the impact is real. And we're seeing it right now. The New York Times CBS poll that came out that basically said the wrong track number now has gone back up to 70 in this country. And if you're a president of the United States and you've got a country with 70% wrong track, less than 30% of the people thinking we're heading in the right direction, your reelection is endangered. And so this gas issue is a real one. President Obama realizes that he must deal with it, and I think that's what he's doing right now.
Now, you were a young sprout working in the Carter administration. President Carter, it's always the president who comes to mind when you think about gas prices sinking a campaign. Now, President Carter tried to handle this thing, too.
Well, I think you can see, if you look back at President Carter and the way he dealt with the issue of gas prices and the way it's being dealt with today, two very different approaches, I think, politically. President Carter looked at it, and he had looked at the energy issue throughout the course of his presidency and gave several speeches about it, and essentially decided—
He kept trying to encourage the nation to move to alternate sources of energy. He created the Energy Department. He did a lot of things about
it. He did
energy.
A lot of substantive things, and he did a lot of other things that people remember, like wearing a sweater and turning down a thermostat. You know, and essentially what happened in the midst of that gas crisis in the mid-1979 was that President Carter gave maybe the most important speech of his presidency, where he basically said to people, listen, we've got to deal with these issues as a crisis of confidence in this country. We've got to take it on. And I think people saw in him someone who was not on their side. When it came to rising gas prices, for example, he said, listen, the problem is the American people using too much petroleum. We're too reliant on it. We've got to do something about it. We've got to change our ways. I think what President Obama is doing today is saying, I'm going to stand on the side of people. That's why he did what he did by announcing there'd be a task force to look into whether or not there was fraud or manipulation in the gas prices. There's very little a president can do, but they can pick sides. President Obama has done it, and I think he's done it in a fundamentally different way than President Carter did.
Now, in other years, when we thought that the price of a barrel of oil was going to, you know, hit 50, hit 90, hit 100, now it's at over 125, that it would remain high forever, but then generally OPEC, led by Saudi Arabia and occasionally Nigeria, would relent. They'd increase the supplies, the price would go down, and all of a sudden we'd be back in the neighborhood of $2 gas. Do you think that the revolutionary effort in Libya and all of the things that are going on in the Middle East right now, does that mean that OPEC is not going to save our bacon once again?
I think that's part of it. There's also growing demand around the world for petroleum products. I mean, China, India, these economies which are emerging as gigantic competitive economies are going to rely on petroleum as a principal source of energy. And as a result of that competition, I don't think there is going to be pressure for them to cut the price. There's going to be pressure for them to raise the price. So we're really in a fix here. Either we're going to change our ways, which is what President Obama is advocating, and move our...
And other presidents have
advocated. I mean, listen, I don't think anybody talked about energy more than Jimmy Carter. Okay, he tried to make it a centerpiece of his presidency, and it went nowhere. And frankly, energy policy, you know, hasn't evolved much in the last three decades. And it's really going to be an issue in this presidential campaign that Obama has to deal with. And I think if he deals with it by convincing people that he's done everything he possibly could, then it will not be something that sinks him.
Tad Devine is a political consultant with the firm of Devine Mulvey. He joined us in our studio. Thank you very much for coming in.
Good to be with you.
This weekend in Akron, Ohio, hundreds of people lined up to admire, caress, and maybe even buy old books. They were gathered at an antiquarian book festival. Even in the age of the Kindle and the iPad, booksellers there are keeping the faith that traditional books will never go away, if they're special, if they evoke memories, and if they have that certain smell. M.L. Schulze from member station WKSU was there. She sent us this postcard.
It's 10 minutes before the 29th annual Northern Ohio Antiquarian Book Fair opens, and there's already a line down the hall at the John S. Knight Convention Center. Inside, some four dozen dealers are carefully setting up their displays of thousands of books. Some books are wrapped in plastic. Others invite the browsers to flip through. There are old cookbooks and first edition mysteries signed by the authors, arcane collections like Arkham House Publishers, and really prime copies of juvenile books like Raphael Sabatini's Captain Blood. The prices range from $10 to as much as $3,000. Shar Douglas is at her stand, checking her smartphone for directions to a chicken restaurant for dinner.
We're not Luddites here. Although we are dealing in a product that maybe many people feel is just so 20th century. But no, we sell online. I have a Droid here.
But she does not have a Kindle, and she does not intend to get one.
I like to touch books. There's just something about turning a page and holding it in your hand that's part of the visceral experience of reading. I'm contemporary. I mean, I like electronic gadgets, just not those electronic gadgets.
High school sophomore Amelia Britton has been shopping at the book fair with her family for years. She says she's no technophobe, but there's nothing, nothing like a book. Better yet, a whole bunch of books.
You walk into an old bookshop and there's tons of books just all over the place, and you can walk along and feel on the bookshelves like the spines, and you just go down the row.
That emotion is even tied to smell. Becky Scott says everyone at the book fair knows that smell. She says it's the smell of a very comfortable memory.
The old paper, it has a rag content to it, so it just smells different than newspapers or books nowadays. You walk into a bookshop that's been there maybe for 40 years and you say, ah, the smell of the books. And maybe there's a little tobacco mixed in with it. I mean, it's just a nostalgic smell.
Reen Alley knows that smell and the thrill of the hunt for one of the dozens of books she's looking for. I pull out my cell phone and show her my downloaded books. She's got me beat.
I have some books that were printed in 1798. And the history of that book is in the book itself. So I know where it traveled from Ireland to England to Cape Cod to Boston.
But the number of dealers at this fair is down. There used to be a dozen more. And like the big booksellers like Borders and Joseph Beth, many of the small dealers are struggling. Some blame it on the Kindle, but not Ken Hebenstreet. Like the others, he loves a good book, and he doesn't even have a cell phone. But he sees a silver lining created by e-books for his rare first editions.
If the printed stuff ever goes away, it'll just make them rarer.
So the dealers say the trick is to have special books to sell, ones that have just the right smell. For NPR News, I'm M.L. Schulze.
Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
The president has said that where we have some unique capabilities, he is willing to use those. And in fact, he has approved the use of armed predators.
That's Defense Secretary Robert Gates speaking from the Pentagon about the U.S. adding drone attacks to NATO's air support of rebels in Libya. And in fact, those drones are already at work in the vicinity of Misrata. James Fallows of The Atlantic joins us, as he does most Saturdays. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Linda.
Now, the U.S. had handed military control of the operation in Libya over to NATO. Now it appears the U.S. is back in it, if in a rather impersonal way through the drones.
Yes, and in a way, I think this was inevitable, or at least predictable early on, because the disproportion of military force within NATO is so great that the U.S. in the long run was going to have to pick up the slack in this way. The point I would like to make is sort of abstracting from Libya in particular, just to recognize this moment in America's military place in the world. Early in our country's history, we were involved in a lot of smallish wars, if you want. The Marine Corps talks about the shores of Tripoli because the Marines were fighting there during the Barbary Wars in the early 1800s. But in the 20th century, the U.S. got used to having wars being big things. There were declarations of war, there was a draft, there were often war taxes, et cetera, et cetera. And since the end of the draft and the end of the Vietnam War, we've very, very frequently, almost constantly, been in combat, but not in a formal way. There are not these formal declarations of war. There's certainly not a draft. And with the drones, there's kind of one more degree of separation between all of the American feedback loops that would go into the consciousness of being at war and the actual wars we are committed to and the things we are doing around the world.
But on the other hand, Jim, when you look at the predators and at the bombing missions that the U.S. was involved in and in the Balkans, there are far fewer American casualties with this kind of war at a distance.
Sure. And this is the good and potentially the bad of this kind of war. I say potentially the bad in two ways. One is a point that David Ignatius of the Washington Post made in a very strong column this week when he pointed out that within the Muslim world, this very remove and distance of American troops, of having controllers in Nevada sending Hellfire missiles down to Muslim countries, that had become a very significant PR problem, if you will, for the U.S. in the Muslim world. Moreover, I would argue that in the long run, while it's useful for a big military power to have a range of options, it probably is not good for a republic in the very long run to have such distance between the things it is doing and the people it is blowing up, you know, for arguably good reasons around the world, and the domestic awareness of that fact.
Finally, Jim, this week, Amazon.com's venture into the brave new world of cloud computing hit a little bump. An outage at Amazon Cloud knocked popular websites like Foursquare and Reddit off the web. So what, we're looking at a cloud burst here?
Yes, indeed, with the wonderfully named EC2 or Elastic Compute Cloud that Amazon has been running. And I think this certainly is not the end of cloud computing because this is a fundamental technology which will become more and more important. But I think this is a moment of loss of innocence about it, where people, I think, will again recognize that some of the cumbersome practicalities of the old age, the need for fallbacks, the need for redundancy, the need for extra security system, and all the rest, which they thought that going to the cloud might spare them, that these unglamorous practicalities will come back into view.
James Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic, and you can read his blog at jamesfallows.theatlantic.com. Jim, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you, Linda.
The tornadoes that struck St. Louis are just the latest in a record-breaking number of twisters that have swept across the country this month. Not to mention historic droughts and fires in Texas, record cold in Seattle, and snow and flooding in the Middle West. So the perennial question of spring, what is with this weather? We asked John Christie. He's director of the Earth System Science Center at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. The culprit, he says, high pressure in the middle of the country.
The main storm track in the last few months has been through the Ohio Valley and trailing down through the southeastern United States. The normally random pattern of storminess has sort of been focused more along the Ohio Valley.
And this is also a La Nina year. And I understand that La Nina is causing lots of things to happen. I mean, who is La Nina and why is she doing this to us?
La Nina is a pattern of temperatures in the central Pacific Ocean. When they are colder than average, that's a La Nina. That is actually part of the mechanism that helps to steer the jet stream, which also steers the storms. And therefore, you get these repeated storms coming in a particular area, and then repeated misses of storms in places like Texas and New Mexico.
Now, the story that I'm the most interested in, because it's something that I remember from my childhood, is tornadoes. There have been more than 240 tornadoes reported since last Thursday. The National Weather Service says this is an increase over last year. Is this part of some kind of trend? Are tornadoes on the rise?
Well, it turns out when you look at the type of tornadoes that we have been able to count for the past 60 years, there really is no trend at all in those numbers. There are many tornadoes now that we detect with Doppler radars. You know, my favorite is the video device that, you know, millions of people now have little video cameras. And the demand for that use on Facebook and YouTube and hundreds of cable channels for this reality TV kind of disaster video is so great that today a tornado has a tough time not being observed. And plus, the stuff that's in the way that we build on the ground is being destroyed at a greater rate simply because there's more stuff out there for them to hit.
Now, there were some elements of this recent storm system that seemed to me to be quite remarkable. For example, we saw a video of three tornadoes which appeared to be rotating around each other.
Yes, that's a multiple vortice tornado. Now, that's not a typical storm that you're describing, but
thank
it
God.
Has been noted in the past.
Then there was a tornado in southern Alabama that plowed up the ground for 35 miles. That seems extraordinary.
35 miles is a long track tornado. It means that the parent thunderstorm from which the tornado came had enough energy to stay active. In that case, with the Gulf moisture continuing to flow from the south and the active front that was moving through was able to keep that storm alive for a long time.
So, John Christie, we're looking at the wild weather continuing?
The wild weather is part of what happens in the United States in spring. I would certainly say somewhere in the United States you will see some more wild weather coming this year. However, I think the tornado outbreak that we experienced last weekend, you know, is a fairly unusual event. You just don't see those happening more than once a year.
John Christie is a man of many titles. He's director of the Earth System Science Center at the University of Alabama in Huntsville, and he's also a climatologist for the state of Alabama. He joined us from WLRH in Huntsville. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Red on Red is a new novel written by a New York City police detective named Edward Conlon. It's his first run at fiction. His first book, which did very well, was nonfiction, a memoir of his first years on the police force called Blue Blood. No relation to the television program with a similar name. He's also written a column about cops for New Yorker magazine, although under another name. Ed Conlon joins us from our studio in New York City. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Now, your book is called Red on Red. What does that mean, Red on Red?
It's a military term for when the enemy turns on the enemy. And it's analogous to what we in a detective business, or at least New York City Police Department, calls an exceptional clearance. That's when you're hunting for somebody and you know that he did it, and somebody else takes him out before you can get arrested. Now, I like the title Exceptional Clearance, but it also sounded a little bit too much like a Steven Seagal movie. So I went for the military version.
Okay. It seems as though this is not a detective novel in the sort of traditional sense, like, you know, the detective novels we all read on airplanes. Generally speaking, crime novels, you know, start with a crime, work its way through to a solution, and then they end. I think it's one of the reasons people like them. They have a kind of very disorderly but orderly progression. Your book's not like that. Why not?
Because that's not the police work as I've experienced it, and that's not storytelling as I enjoy doing it. It's you wander a bit, and you make mistakes, and things are not clear. In a detective work, this is not Agatha Christie stuff. You know, this is messy and often pointless, real crazy life.
It seems like the main focus of the book, the two detectives, Esposito and Meehan, are two very different kinds of men, and that seems to be a principal part of what you're doing here.
These are sort of marriages, these cop partnerships. I mean, there's reasons why they lend themselves to drama. You're with somebody, you're with the person you work with for sometimes, you know, 48 hours at a stretch, and you change each other, you affect each other. You know, it's always the sort of the B plot of all the TV series, you know. The A plot is, you know, the girl got kidnapped or somebody got shot, and the B plot is, you know, Sipowitz drinking again or what's happening to his marriage. But the fierce attachments and competition between police partners is what drives this drama.
You know, when I was trying to describe what it is that this book is like, I kept coming around to the idea that it was an allegory, that you were talking about some sort of stroll through hell here.
That didn't occur to me. See, I think
I'm
Washington
giving you
Heights
more
is...
literary credit than you want, huh?
I think Washington Heights is a great part of town. You know, it was, you know, in the 80s and 90s, you know, the murder capital of New York City. It was the center of the crack trade. It's calmed down significantly since then. But it's still a complicated part of town where beyond the, you know, the sort of real city stuff, I mean, you're also very close to nature. I mean, it's full of parks. The river is right there. It's a place where you can walk a few feet and be in the last bit of original forest in Manhattan, where the Indians made their infamous bad deal
with the Dutch, right?
That's right. That's right.
So, do you think this book is? Does it reflect your experiences? Have you had similar sorts of experiences and doubts and concerns and panic attacks as these guys do?
Sure. You know, nothing is in the book is directly taken from real life. There's a lot of worst-case scenarios. There's a lot of what-ifs. There are some surface details and situations that did come from life. I mean, there's a scene with a bloodhound pursuit in a blizzard that guys in my squad were involved with. Literally, you know, uptown Manhattan, snow falling, getting too deep almost to walk while the bloodhound is leading you forward for a kidnapper in the real-life case. Some of these things are too good to resist. I mean, the difficulty really in writing this book was that my day job gave me so much material. You know, for example, we had a homicide and we got some information that the guy was hiding out in a tenement in Brooklyn. As it happens, our fugitive was being harbored by an elderly blind man. And this guy, who is talking to a policeman on his fire escape, keeps on insisting that he has to see my ID. Well, you know, he's blind. I mean, I could have shown him a baseball card. I could have showed him the ace of spades. And, you know, I don't think he has lots of conversations with people on his fire escape. And I thought that was such a strange and almost allegorical situation that I'd have to use it. But there was no place for it.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't get in.
Lots of stuff was cut.
So when you started out writing about the world of policing, you first began with a memoir. When you moved over into fiction from writing your memoir, from writing the column, which, as you said, was a sort of a straight-ahead factual account of things that happened, did it feel different?
It felt a lot freer. One of the reasons why I, you know, continued to work with people who were happy to work with me as a cop after having written a book is that I could go into other characters' personal lives and make them messy and make them conflicted and complicated in a way that writing nonfiction, I mean, other people's, aside from casework, and it was none of my business. It felt freer, but I think I might have been, you know, that freedom itself was something I had a little trouble managing in the early drafts.
How do your friends on the force feel about this, that you have written a book that describes, even if it's not absolutely literal, a lot of the things or the kinds of things that you've all experienced together?
It's been overwhelmingly positive because I'm just talking about what it's like to do this. And this is, you know, police work is, you know, sensationalized and it's controversial and it's many, many things. But I'm somebody who's proud of doing this job, who has explained it in a very, and told stories about it in a pretty matter-of-fact way.
And do you plan to continue to be a police detective?
Sure. I did not expect to be here, you know, 16-plus years ago when I first started walking a beat in the housing projects of the South Bronx, so I think I know better than to predict, but yeah, I'll be here for a bit.
New York City Detective Ed Conlon. His new novel is called Red on Red. Thank you.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is Weekends on All Things Considered. Guy Raz is away. I'm Linda Wertheimer. The topic that dominated the political conversation this week was rising gas prices. The national average is approaching $4 a gallon. It's a chunk of change out of our pockets, maybe a harbinger of inflation. President Obama focused on gas prices in his weekly radio address today and from the road all week. But we couldn't help thinking we've heard this song before.
Gas prices, gas prices, gas prices.
National average for a gallon of gas will likely hit
$3.17 per gallon for regular unleaded gasoline.
There's no escape the pain at the pump.
Those clips are not from this week, as you can hear, not even this year. Dick Pohlman, national political columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, says he's covered this story a few times.
The narrative arc is that the prices jump. We get visuals on cable news of the digital readouts at the pump, anecdotal interviews of people filling their cars and being angry.
I'm not going to be happy.
I was like, man, that's too high.
Does it drive me nuts? Yeah.
But you have to put gas in your car.
Then you get people in the opposing party saying something ought to be done about this.
Americans looking at the price of gas at the pump these days are justifiably upset.
We're about to get into the high driving season.
Then whoever's in the White House turns around and says we're going to try to get to the bottom of this.
The administration are actively working to prevent us from increasing our own oil
House
production
Republicans
here at
want
home.
To do something to now. Immediately began the orderly sale.
So everybody sort of covers themselves
of
politically.
Strategic petroleum reserve to try to moderate the price of fuel.
In a few months, prices stabilize, or maybe they dip a little bit, and everybody just goes back about their daily business as if it never happened, and then the next time, it happens as if it's for the first time.
Pain at the pump is getting ready to make a comeback.
These prices are just absolutely ridiculous.
They jumped to a two-year high.
Sticker shock is back at your local gas station.
Prices at the pump now...